You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com, in a conversation that's being recorded on the 2nd of March, 2017. And you'll probably have seen by now that Donald J. Trump, the President of the United States, just gave an address to a joint session of Congress in which he warned of the ever-present boogeyman threat of the jihadis who are waiting behind every bush to slit your throat and drink your blood. Or is that a bush behind every jihadi? Ha ha ha. I jest, but I should not jest, because of course we are in this age of the war of terror in which the Department of Justice and the FBI are waging their valiant war against all of these would-be terrorists. And lo and behold, in the midst of all of this, just in the last couple of weeks, we've had word of the first FBI terror sting under President Trump and under a newly sworn in Attorney General Jeff Sessions. And who is this dastardly terrorist? To find out more about that, we're going to be talking to Murtaza Hussain. His article is up at The Intercept. It's under the headline, Trump's First Terror Arrest, A Broke Stoner the FBI Threatened at Knife Point. Murtaza Hussain, thank you very much for joining me today on The Corbett Report.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's hear about this terror arrest that has just taken place. Who is Robert Lorenzo Hester?
He's a young man in Kansas who was arrested on charges of allegedly attempting to provide material support, take part in a terrorist plot. He was arrested a few weeks ago as part of an FBI undercover sting that lasted several months and involved a number of informants who helped Mr. Hester, or developed for Mr. Hester, a plot and tried to win his engagement to take part in it. And when they seemed to have won some sort of commitment, they moved in and made an arrest. And he's facing a pretty lengthy jail sentence now.
All right, let's go through this plan, this plot that was concocted with Robert or for Robert by the informants that he was with. How did he get involved in all of this? What's his background?
Well, the way it happened is that Mr. Hester was posting on Facebook things which seemed to be, when I looked at them, not particularly belligerent or out there, but certainly anti-government tone. And then he was befriended on that platform on Facebook by someone who, unbeknownst to him, was an informant. The informant began messaging him and sort of, you know, trying to get his talk developed further and complimenting him on the polls. And this continued on for some time. And Mr. Hester came from a bit of a troubled background. He was getting in trouble with the law in totally unrelated ways during this period. And then at some point, this informant he was communicating with online offered to introduce him to another informant in person. And that informant ended up showing up at Mr. Hester's house. Workplace and driving him home from work and giving him money, and he befriended him, and then he started like developing this idea for a plot with him, or more like the informant himself developed an idea, and then he started trying to see if he'd interest Mr. Hester, and it was not really clear how deeply interested Mr. Hester was, because according to the criminal complaint, the informant had to pull a knife on him at one point to ensure his compliance with certain restrictions he wanted put on behavior, and he threatened to harm him and his family. He has two young children. So it's a very murky case, but it looks like it never would have happened if the informants hadn't come up with a plot.
Surprise, surprise. And you relate some of the interesting parts of this story in here that show that perhaps this was not the dastardly terrorist mastermind that the FBI is now making him out to be. The fact that he brought along his children to meetings with this informant because he couldn't afford daycare, or that he was a devout pot smoker, despite being apparently a Muslim of some sort. Tell us about the clues that we have that perhaps Hester was not exactly the ideal image of an ISIS jihadist.
Yeah, exactly. So the thing is, he seemed like a troubled guy. He seemed like somebody who's, like I said, he was getting troubled law for normal, more so I should say, generic sort of reasons. But if you look at his history and even his behavior during the investigation, he did not seem very menacing or capable of carrying out anything as outrageous as a terrorist act. He was seemed to be very frequently inebriated, marijuana. He was described as a hardcore ISIS jihadi, but he actually only converted to Islam very recently, in the course of months, it seems like. And he didn't seem to know anything about it. He even told the informant he was not really knowledgeable about it in any sense. He was just a delinquent, and not even a very common one. Another thing that the informant had to do was repeatedly give him money because he didn't have enough money to get by. He couldn't even come up with $20 at one point to buy basic supplies that the informant asked him to buy. He asked him to buy some hardware supplies and tape and nails and things like that. And the informants were able to confirm that he couldn't come up with the money. So they had to pay him. They had to pay him repeatedly. And he just generally seemed like a very, perhaps not sympathetic, but certainly pathetic individual who was being portrayed as this great menace to society. And I really, you know, even based purely on the government's version of events, just doesn't seem to be the case.
Right. So this, as you paint the picture quite vividly, does not appear, certainly is, I don't think we can say that Mr. Hester was a innocent angel in all of this. He did have some sort of intent or express some sort of intent at some point, but he certainly was not able to put together a plot of any sort by himself, let alone a plot of the kind that the FBI is now alleging that he was a ringleader of, or an attempted ringleader of. So I think the only thing that's remarkable about this story for people who know how this has happened time and time and time and time again over the past 15 years is how unremarkable it is, how this fits exactly into the pattern that's been painted in the Liberty City 7 and the Christmas tree bomber and many, many, many other examples of people who have been basically set up and put on the terror path by informants. And of course, I think the journalist that did the groundbreaking work on this was Trevor Arneson. He wrote The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism, in which he broke down the basically legion of 15,000 plus informants that the FBI has spread out across the United States looking to create plots if they can't find any, and then bust them and swoop in and be the terror busting heroes. For people who don't know about this context of the FBI and how this modus operandi has not changed under any attorney general, from all the way back from Ashcroft all the way up to Sessions, let's talk a little bit about that context.
Right. This is just the typical way that they've used to inflate the perception that terrorism is ubiquitous in the United States. Certainly, if you were to take these numbers and these headlines at face value, it may seem that way. But it seems like very often that the narrative put forward about these cases tends to fall apart under some scrutiny. Not to say that there's never any legitimate investigation or that all of these cases are manufactured, but it certainly is the case that a very significant number of them do not seem like they would have ever happened were it not for the involvement of the government in developing and implementing the plots, often at great expense, great investigative resources and time invested. Events generally turn very vulnerable people into these headlines, caricatures of terrorists, and often the cases sending them to jail for very lengthy prison terms. I think that it serves a purpose in inflating our perception of how much terrorism exists, and in doing so, justifying the continuance of these huge budgets that go towards counterterrorism, perhaps much more than that would be needed if we had a more measured perception of what's going on. And I think Mr. Hester's case is a perfect example of that. It's just, he's like many other people in the United States, he's not necessarily a model citizen. And you don't have to be a model citizen to be allowed to live in society. But the idea that he is an ISIS terrorist seems quite spurious, despite the fact that that's what's been reported generally. It seems to be very, very distant from reality. It seems to have been marked or very sophisticated people who seem to have viewed him as an undesirable, who they're going to take it out of society one way or another, and they succeeded in that. And at the same time, they've generated these headlines. So that's something that's been happening for years and years.
Exactly right. And I think the generating the headlines is really part of the purpose of all of this, because people remember the headlines and they remember the scary names and faces that are paraded across the screen for their 2 minutes hate. But then the story itself gets lost when the cases usually fall apart under prosecution. So let's talk about where things go here for Mr. Hester. What is he facing, and what's his trial schedule like?
He has a hearing coming up. He's facing 20 years in jail, pretty significant financial penalties as well. And the thing is, the prognosis in these cases is not good. There is a near 100% conviction rate in terrorist cases that go to trial. I would predict he will take a plea sometime in the next few months that will result in a reduced sentence. Now, having said that, there are things about his case that are unique in some way, or uniquely pernicious, I would say. The fact, above all, that the informant threatened him with a knife and threatened to kill him and his family with a knife as part of the investigation, that is above and beyond even in these cases. And that might give him a slightly better opportunity to fight these charges. But having said that, that would be very far out of the norm that someone defeats a case like this at trial. And I still think that in all likelihood, what will happen is that Mr. Hester will take a plea and you'll see him go to jail for some number of years. Over the next year, you'll see something like that.
And just to be clear, the account of the informant pulling the knife and threatening Hester and his family, that comes from Hester or that comes from the informant?
That comes from the government's criminal complaint documents. So the criminal complaint sort of itemized a blow-by-blow of how the investigation proceeded, and that was in there. The government themselves put that in there.
That is mind-blowing. I mean, that does raise the question of what exactly are informants allowed or not allowed to do in the course of their informing? Are they allowed to threaten people and threaten their lives and threaten their families if they don't go along with the plot that the informant is creating? Is that legal?
Well, to clarify, it wasn't the fact that he pulled it to demand him to go along with the plot. He pulled it to demand him to comply with some other direction, to not do anything or to not divulge information about the plot or to not do anything other than what's been said, something like that. But, the thing is, that's, again, their narrative of it. And I can easily see if you're Mr. Hester, you don't know who these people are and they're threatening to kill you and you're scared of them. And then you start saying yes and find everything that they tell you to do. So is it legal? That's a very good question. It seems like very much a gray zone, but it certainly boosts up the idea that this is a trap, and there's not been a successful case argued since any of these cases post 9/11 of entrapment in terrorism cases. But I mean, as you said, it's my own. Just the fact that they pull a knife and threaten to kill his family over any reason during an investigation to ensure that he does as he's told is something that should give all of us pause.
Well, I know that you are covering cases like this for The Intercept. You do work on human rights, foreign policy, cultural affairs, but you talk quite a bit about radical Islam and counter-extremism in the U.S. and ISIS and these types of plots and how they are magnified in the media. Tell us a little bit about your work.
Yeah, so the general crux of it, I would say, falls under national security and sometimes immigration. Those are some of the main focuses. How this entire web of institutions and practices knit together, both at here and abroad, and how it affects our lives in a number of ways, just not far beyond just the arrest, but creates a toxic social environment, breeds political extremism that we're seeing in the United States today. And I think the war on terror, which is apparently limitless, is undeniably having a corrosive effect on American democratic culture and, society more broadly.
Well, I'm glad there are people like yourself documenting these cases and getting to the bottom of some of the really ridiculous things that are revealed in these documents that, of course, are not really thoroughly reported on, although the headlines, of course, make their way into the media, but little else. So I'm glad to see your reporting on this. Murtaza Hussain, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
The Corbett Report is brought to you by the Corbett Report subscriber. A weekly newsletter featuring James Corbett's International Forecaster editorial, recommended reading and viewing, discounts on Corbett Report DVDs, and once a month, a subscriber-only video. Sign up today to start receiving your copy at corbettreport.com/support.